others led the way. The climb was indeed a bit strenuous, but Sarah was grateful once again for the view and the opportunity to linger. She would never forget Pavenham Sky, and she could only hope to return one day and climb that tree, but not with anyone watching. By the time she reached the top of the cliff, her legs were sore, and she was sweating and a little out of breath. She was also very thirsty. The others had assembled at the stone pavilion and were chatting gaily with each other. Servants with trays brought them drinks, and the light of the fire revealed their animated faces. As Sarah drew closer, she heard music emanating from one of the clearings. A servant approached her with a tray, and she recognized him instantly. There was a single chalice on it, which he offered her with a slight nod. "Thank you," she said, taking it. Her throat was parched, and she took a long draught of the sweet-flavored nectar. It was a blend of different juices, very subtle but refreshing. He bowed again and turned to leave without saying a word. "What is your name?" she asked him, and he startled a bit.
"I am known as Trevin Wickford, if you please, ma'am,"
he answered meekly.
"And where are you from, Trevin Wickford?"
she asked again as he was about to leave. He paused again and turned to look at her.
"I'm from the north."
She took another sip.
"Dundrennan, perhaps?"
She was hoping that her reference of a duchy in Kingfountain would stir a reaction from him. His eyes crinkled around the edges.
"No, ma'am."
"Your name isn't Trevin," she said softly.
"I am known as..."
Then she offered a little chuckle.
"You won't lie outright, that's good news. Your Highness," she said, inclining her head to him.
He was struggling not to smile.
"What gave me away?"
he asked in an almost whisper.
"Did someone tell you I was here?"
"No,"
she answered, shaking her head.
"Just a feeling."
He pursed his lips.
"Indeed. Are you going to reveal me in front of the others now?"
"I assume Lady Corinne knows."
"Of course. The disguise was my idea. You get to know a lot about someone from how they treat others, especially from how they treat people lower than themselves. You are the only one who thanked me for the drink, by the way."
"Your accent is impeccable," Sarah said. "I always heard that our languages are very different, though I've never met someone from Kingfountain before."
"Thank you, but I cannot take credit. Language is a gift from the fountain. Our cultures are similar in some ways, but they are also very different."
He glanced back at the pavilion.
"And I see we're attracting too much unwanted attention. So, do you plan to reveal me, Miss Fitzempress?"
"I can keep a secret,"
she answered, taking another sip from the chalice. Chapter 25 Testimony. Sarah secretly enjoyed herself as she watched the prince in disguise serve each of the young ladies gathered around the fire pit. Some hardly paid him notice at all, taking what refreshment they were offered without even looking at him. Others seemed to recognize him as the disruptive servant from earlier in the day and gave him a slightly curled lip and a look of disdain. Miss Mortensen's reaction was especially hostile, and Sarah had to shield her face, for she nearly burst out laughing. Sarah honored her word, however, and did not reveal the young impostor. Yes, he was getting a fair assessment of each young lady. The tide came in, and soon the waves were crashing against the walls of cliffs beneath them. A cool breeze followed soon after, but the warmth from the fire clearings drove away the chill. A few young ladies took the opportunity to talk to Sarah again, which she recognized as an attempt to curry favor. But if she'd learned anything from her visit to Pavenham Sky, it was that she had not missed much in terms of friendship by being kept away from these young ladies when she was younger. Her parents, flawed as they were, had at least shielded her from the pretenders who would puff up her feathers and the more competitive girls who would seek to best her at every turn. The encounters she had with the others made her even more grateful for her relationship with Seti. She wondered how her friend would have been treated in such a gathering. Probably not very well. Several hours after the gathering had started beneath the pavilion, Sarah noticed the butler, Mr. Sewell, approach Lady Corinne and whisper something in her ear.
The man had a concerned look, and Sarah shifted forward in her seat, but she was unable to hear any of the words. Lady Corinne's expression changed to one of concern. She nodded, touching the butler's arm, and then rose and quickly approached Sarah. The conversation in the pavilion abruptly ended, and all watched to see what would happen. "Your tempest has been put on alert," Lady Corinne said in a quiet way. "The Privy Council has called an emergency meeting, and your presence is required." The news made Sarah's heart beat faster.
"Do you know what it is about?"
Lady Corinne shook her head. "Your skyship will come down here to whisk you back to Lockhaven. The word just arrived. I am grateful to have met you, Miss Fitzempress. Thank you for coming to Pavenham Sky." The other girls began to murmur to each other in low voices, no doubt speculating what situation could have demanded Sarah's immediate return. The tempest descended from the upper heights of the estate and came down to meet her on the grassy knoll by the cliffs. Sarah saw Hugild on board, leaning over the railing as she approached the ship with Lady Corinne and Mr. Sewell, who personally escorted her. "Have a safe voyage," Lady Corinne offered.
"Thank you for your hospitality," Sarah replied.
They lowered the gangplank, and Sarah strode up the steep ramp until she reached the ship. One look at Hugild told her that her old governess was worried, but didn't know anything herself. Before she could ask, Hugild said,
"I don't know, Sarah. A message came through the Leering from the Minister of War himself, ordering the Tempest to fetch you and bring you back. Something has happened, but not even the captain knows what."
Sarah didn't like being kept in the dark. She walked to the edge of the rails and watched as the gangplank was raised back on board. The tempest lurched, making her sway and catch herself on the railing bar. The small gathering of young women and servants quickly rushed away, and she thought about the young prince in disguise. Although she was more intrigued by him than she'd expected to be, she still felt her duty and her destiny was toward her own people, not his. But then she saw him standing amidst the dispersing crowd. He was the only one watching her skyship rise. Their eyes met for a brief moment. The speed of the skyship increased, and from her vantage point she could see the surf crashing below and could even spy the huge fallen tree amidst the waves. She wondered if she would ever return to the famous manor. And if she did, would it be as empress? The tempest reached Lockhaven by morning. Sarah had managed a few hours of fitful sleep in her stateroom on board, but she was drowsy and a little short-tempered when Hugild helped her into a new gown and redid her hair for the meeting with the council. Looking at her own reflection in the mirror, she saw the gray smudges beneath her eyes and frowned at herself. There were many tempests moored at the docking yard, but they were all military, save one. It was a merchant vessel bearing the name Serpentine. The moniker sounded familiar to her, but she could not place it. After disembarking from the ship, she approached the entrance to the palace. Mr. Durant awaited her at the opening, looking disheveled and wary.
"Do you know what this is about?"
Sarah asked him, and he quickly shook his head no.
"I do not. Whatever it is has been declared a state secret, and only members of the Privy Council are to be told. A merchant ship arrived before yours, and some people were ushered into the palace, a man and a woman. That's all I know. This way."
He took her arm and started to tow her toward the Privy Council chamber. "Mr. Durant, I have a question for you," she said as they walked swiftly.
"I will do my best to answer it," he replied.
"When I was visiting Pavenham Sky, Lady Corinne took me aside. She gave me several letters, still sealed, from my father addressed to her. She asked me to return them to him. I have them with me now."
His eyes bulged with surprise.
"Did she indeed? Have you opened them?"
"No, of course not."
"Of course not? Why not? They could contain information that could ruin your father's credibility with the Privy Council."
He chuffed, shaking his head.
"If you have qualms about reading them, I certainly do not. A decision is likely to be made very soon. This could be just what we need for victory. May I see them?"
he asked eagerly. Sarah still felt rather unsure about the situation. She'd been wrestling with her conscience all day, and yes, had she not constantly been in the company of others while at Pavenham Sky, she likely would have opened one by now. She'd been sorely tempted during the journey back to Lockhaven, but had decided to ask the advice of Mr. Durant and Lord Fitzroy before she did so. It was evident what Mr. Durant's opinion was. "We will discuss it after the Privy Council meeting," she told him.
"But Sarah," he urged, "I can read them and think of a suitable plan while you are in the meeting."
"Later, Mr. Durant," she said firmly.
"Of course,"
he demurred, but she could see the sign of resentment in his eyes. Some servants and military men were gathered just outside the council room. Sarah was always one to look at faces, and she stopped suddenly when she recognized the Prince of King Fountain's face amidst those gathered there. It startled her to see he'd somehow beaten her to the meeting. How was it possible? He met her gaze, and a half-smile came to his mouth when he realized she recognized him. This time he was disguised as a soldier. She gave him an accusatory look, but then she was ushered into the room. She looked back at him, trying to untangle what was going on. But then the door was shut behind her, and she saw that the Privy Council had gathered and had been waiting for her. Lord Fitzroy was present this time, conferring with two people she had never met before and who were not part of the council. Her father was in his usual seat, but there was a guilty, worried look in his eyes rather than his usual blustery confidence. Did he know about the letters? Had Lady Corinne told him that he would be getting them back? Neither Mr. Durant nor Hugilt had been permitted to enter, so she quickly came around and took her seat near her father's. The room came to order immediately.
"All right, Fitzroy," her father said grudgingly. "She's here now. I can't believe we've had to wait this long."
Although her father's tone was condescending, Fitzroy would not be ruffled. He looked haggard and weary, as if he had been up all night, but he spoke calmly in reply.
"I appreciate your patience, Prince Regent," Fitzroy said, "and to avoid taxing it further, I will be to the point. Yesterday, the Privy Council authorized the use of the Crusader Orb to hunt down the Kishian, who shot the Aldermaston of Mirwood. This man beside me is Calton Forshee, a teacher at Billerbeck Abbey and the operator of the orb. The woman is my sister-in-law, Juliana Houghton. I will summarize the events of last evening, and then they will answer any questions you may have. Agreed?"
"Get on with it, then,"
said Sarah's father impatiently. Fitzroy's eyes narrowed at the show of disrespect. He clasped his hands behind his back and then faced the rest of the council.
"As you already know, my youngest daughter was abducted by this Kishian last night. She was dragged outside the Abbey's boundaries of protection."
"How is that possible?"
interrupted Lord Wells. Fitzroy glanced back at Mr. Forshee before returning Lord Wells's gaze.
"The boundaries were tampered with. The Kishian is clearly in possession of a Kistrel. He bore the marks in his eyes. He caused a rift in the boundary, one that didn't trigger the Leerings."
A few muttered gasps filled the air. Sarah had no idea what a Kistrel was other than a breed of falcon she'd heard about in her studies. But their reaction to the word and its dangers was pronounced.
"They were escorted by several armed scouts and followed their quarry into the woods. They found my daughter, but she was possessed. You could almost say she was infected by multiple entities of great power. In the commotion, several of the scouts were killed, the captain of the company was injured severely, and my daughter nearly died. If it were not for Mr. Forshee's gifts with the mysteries of thought, they might all have died last night."
"One correction, Lord Fitzroy," said Mr. Forshee. "Without your ward's help, it could have ended in even more deaths. She's exceptionally gifted."
Sarah felt a rush of pride in Seti and smiled.
"Noted," said Fitzroy. "Thank you." "After they confronted the Kishian and tried to restrain him, he escaped into the woods. Juliana pursued him."
"That wasn't very wise," said one of the councilwomen, and a few others murmured similar comments. Juliana smirked but said nothing. She didn't look the least bit chagrined. Sarah had heard multiple stories about Seti's Aunt Juliana, who piloted a Tempest and worked in the trade routes. The woman certainly met her expectations.
If I may continue, Fitzroy said, clearing his throat.
The room quieted again.
Thank you. Several Zephyrs had been summoned by the captain on duty and were converging on the scene from above. Plenty of men to apprehend such a dangerous individual. He led Juliana on a chase through the murk before reaching the water's edge. As you know, the Abbey is surrounded by water. They expected to find a Zephyr hidden in the woods. They were prepared to intercept it. What she found is the reason this Privy Council was summoned. Sister?
The quiet in the chamber became even more pronounced. It was then that Sarah noticed the bruise on the woman's cheek and mud stains on her knee-high boots. She and Mr. Forshee stood near each other, both weary and unkempt. They must have flown to Lockhaven straight away.
I caught up with the Kishion twice,
Juliana said in a firm, steady voice.
We fought each time that I did, and he got the better of me both times. But I continued to pursue him out of vengeance for what he had done to my niece. The Zephyrs had encircled us by then, and they all shone light down on the area. Some of the dragoons took shots at him, but he was fast, never standing still for very long, and he used the trees as cover. I got back to my feet and pursued him again. He reached the water's edge and the water parted for him, like he repelled the water in a way I don't understand. And he didn't slog through the mud as you'd expect on a lakeshore. He marched right down into the waters on dry ground. There was a ship waiting for him that had been submerged. He opened the cockpit. I only had a quick glimpse, but the hull was made of stone or some sort of marbled metal. After he entered the ship, the waters flooded back, and I could only watch the ripples as it moved away. It was completely underwater. I've never seen a Zephyr do that before. Our ships are designed to float and ride out a storm, not travel underwater. What little I saw of its shape was completely foreign to me. Colton arrived shortly thereafter, having used the orb to track me down. He didn't see it, only I did. Thank you, Juliana, said Fitzroy. I'm grateful you're safe.
As am I, replied Juliana with a laugh, earning a spattering of chuckles from those assembled.
I've never seen a ship like that, and I've spent my life traveling. What does this mean? The Prince Regent asked. Lord Wells, what does it mean?
Lord Wells rose from his seat and put his knuckles on the table.
I spoke to the Prime Minister before this meeting. I had already heard the report, and I'd like to add that the Zephyr crews near the scene also saw something glowing beneath the waters. The craft sank lower and lower before it disappeared. I think this craft, this Sea Zephyr, if you will, is not from this world. As we all know, the world of King Fountain uses a water-based form of magic. Though it has the same source as our own, they have rituals and customs that are very different than ours. Our superiority in the air is unmatched, but we know from our network of spies that their fleet of waterbound ships is vast and powerful. Their navy is unmatched. As we've learned from fighting them in the past, they can strike our ships in the air, just as we can strike theirs at sea. We have been in balance, but this development is alarming. If they have invented ships that can travel beneath the waves undetected, then we will have no warning if they should decide to attack us. Hence the secrecy of this meeting. This overture of marriage may be nothing more than a pretext for another invasion. This offer to trade sciences may be only a distraction. Why buy what they can take? We already know many of their people consider our use of the mysteries an affront, heresy even. They have tried over the centuries to convert us to their ways with logic and pleading, more often with force. Some of our citizens have deliberately abandoned the Empire to join in their ways. Some have returned disillusioned. Some were not permitted to return at all. Perhaps they have invented new weapons they wish to keep secret.
He sighed and looked sternly at those gathered.
Ladies and gentlemen,
We may be on the eve of war.
Lord Fitzroy shook his head.
Why would they send their prince to us to negotiate the marriage proposal himself?
Sarah had been wondering the same.
Maybe we should ask him, she suggested.
The Prime Minister turned to her.
Miss Fitzempress, he is not at Lockhaven presently. He is staying with one of our illustrious families and learning more about our customs.
He was at Pavenham Sky last night,
Sarah answered, ignoring the surprised looks on their faces.
But I tell you, I just saw him outside those doors dressed as one of Lord Wells's soldiers. Bring him in here. Let's ask him directly.
She could tell by the startled looks on their faces that they hadn't known he'd returned. Or how.
Chapter 26. Locked Door. Lord Wells stood abruptly, his face twitching with anger. Several of the council members had turned to give him distrusting looks.
That is a bold accusation, young lady, he said. I would have been told if he were en route back to Lockhaven. Perhaps you are mistaken.
There is one way to find out, Sarah answered. Open the doors.
Wells, how could she know this?
Her father demanded suspiciously.
I don't know, Prince Regent,
he said through gritted teeth.
But as she said, there is one way to find out.
As he pushed away from the table, Sarah rose from her chair and followed him. Lord Fitzroy's eyes had narrowed as well, and he cast a warning look her way. The council members began to chitter among themselves in disbelief. She ignored them all and continued to make her way to the doors. Lord Wells reached them at the same time, his displeasure evident in his scowling mouth. His eyes stared into hers for a moment, almost accusatorily, before he pulled the door open. The cadre of guards was still in place, including the young man she had met the night before. She saw that Wells recognized him instantly.
Would you join us, please?
He asked, his tone rigid. The prince touched his chest in surprise, and Wells nodded firmly. The young man's demeanor immediately turned defensive. He noticed Sarah standing at Wells's elbow and shot her a look of confusion, but he did not hesitate. He nodded and then warily approached the council room door. There was a collective gasp of surprise when the prince entered the room. The young man looked chagrined at the reception, but he strode in purposefully, one hand clasped to his wrist behind his back. His bearing and demeanor took on a more regal attitude, even though he was dressed as a soldier. Sarah's father had come to his feet and was trembling with rage.
Back so soon, Your Highness?
The prince gave the Prince Regent a cool, studied look, and then shifted his gaze for a moment to Sarah.
I was made aware at Pavenham Sky that there had been some trouble. I thought it expedient to return quickly.
How?
Asked Lord Wells flatly, arms folded. The prince swallowed but maintained his composure.
I elect not to answer that question.
You are here as an invited guest,
said Sarah's father.
We have kept all of the terms of the negotiations thus far, and you have been granted unfettered access to our realm. The hostages were exchanged in good faith. But your welcome is not without its limits. You have violated our trust.
How so, sir?
The prince countered.
If I may, Prince Regent, Fitzroy interjected.
No, you may not,
interrupted the Prime Minister. He too had risen.
Is it true, Your Majesty, that your nation has access to ships that sail underwater, that can be completely submerged without sinking? Be wary how you answer us, young lord. No falsehoods may be uttered in these chambers.
Is this a trial?
The prince replied, still patient, though clearly ill at ease.
Am I not entitled to counsel from an advocate before answering?
Is your arrival here but a pretext for war?
The Prime Minister nearly shouted at him. The feeling of animosity and anger in the room was powerful, and it made Sarah cold and fearful.
This animosity must not go unchecked. The prince's lips were a firm line of disapproval. He was offended. He was vulnerable.
Do you think my father would have sent me here if he were planning duplicity?
He finally asked in a cold, measured tone.
Do you think him capable of such a breach of integrity?
Sarah's father's look was full of withering contempt.
You did not answer the question. A question put to you directly.
The prince glanced from face to face.
That you asked it at all says much. I don't know what game you are playing, Prince Regent. Game?
Her father snarled. Please, Sarah said, finding her voice at last. She stepped forward. Can we not all be civil? These accusations do nothing but churn the waters, making it difficult to see. The prince looked at her. She couldn't understand what his look meant, but he finally said,
An apt metaphor, Miss Fitzempress.
She realized he was probably referring to his belief in the fountain. That had not been her intent.
We are not the ones playing games, Prince Trevin,
her father said angrily.
One of our thought leaders was shot by an assassin. The Kishion Order was wiped out in our realm centuries ago, yet your world is renowned for its poisoner school. He uses obscure and improper magic to control water. And then he escaped in a ship that went underwater. Should not these facts cast doubt on your intentions? Was your arrival to woo one of our daughters merely a pretext? Or maybe you will say the fountain commanded it, as if that absolves you from using your free will.
Prince Trevin's face grew pale with rage. Sarah saw his hands clench into fists behind his back. Father had mocked his religion and his people, deliberately.
I think it is past time that I returned to my world,
he said evenly.
Not until you have answered some of our questions,
Lord Wells replied in a dangerous tone. The prince turned and looked at him with contempt.
I begin to see your end game, Lord Wells. A bold move.
Surely, Sarah said, coming closer to the prince. We can resolve this peaceably. If you would but explain yourself, defend yourself. The prince shook his head and she fell silent.
I had hoped to make a peace between our peoples, to end this cycle of war. But this machine your ancestors invented, this business of despair you call your government, knows no other way. It corrupts everything it touches. It won't be stopped. It cannot be stopped unless it is broken. I'm sorry. I should like to have known you better.
It's not too late, Sarah implored. To her surprise, she felt a strong connection with him, an understanding of sorts, and he seemed on the verge of an irrevocable decision.
Sit down, Seraphine,
her father commanded. Anger flashed through her. And your hasty words are helping? She shot back. Then she turned to the prince, extending her open palm. Please, Your Highness, you have the power to put an end to this. Speak the truth. I will believe you.
You do yourself credit,
he answered, but he still looked wary, distrustful.
Yet I see where the true power lies.
He turned and faced Lord Wells.
You forget, Minister, that my people have been playing a game called Wiser for a very long time. These machinations for power are not foreign to us. I see your move, and so I will counter it.
I think not, the Prime Minister said. We have you as a hostage to ensure good faith, and you've broken it.
I think not,
the prince repeated him archly.
Goodbye.
He jerked his arm away, revealing a flash of gleaming brass in his hand. It was a small device, no larger than a small baton, encrusted with jewels. It had clearly been concealed up his sleeve. One moment he was standing in front of them. The next he was gone.
Over the course of the following hours, the Empire switched to a posture of war. The Privy Council was angered by the Prince's sudden and inexplicable departure from the center of the Council Room. Clearly the other kingdom's magic outstripped their own in some ways. The Sky Manors had been a protection for centuries against the sea-bound fleets of King Fountain. But if the Prince could come and go of his own accord, the safety they had enjoyed was now over. Despite Sarah's pleading for a cool-headed response and an examination of the facts, she saw the Council's blood was up. Lord Fitzroy also tried to argue for peace and the further use of diplomacy to resolve the crisis. But logical arguments did little to quell the Council's wounded pride, and even less to combat their fear. The Empire was vulnerable against a threat that had powers they did not understand. Lord Wells was given increased authority to prepare the defenses of the Empire, especially the cities along the coasts, which were deemed the most vulnerable to a surprise attack. Conscription orders were given to bolster the military. Workers would be taken from the factories and pressed into service. And the Ministry of Wind was ordered to screen each new candidate for signs of the cholera morbus. One infected soldier might kill an entire crew. The wheel of commerce would be changed into a wheel of war. The Prince Regent's bellicose words helped inflame the situation. He hungered for the coming conflict, and Sarah saw that many on the council looked to him for leadership and strength. Her impassioned words had not won her any support. If anything, they had harmed her position. She returned to Castlebury, her heart full of anguish at the prospect of the impending conflict. 2 days passed, and from her window she could see the Hurricanes arriving to defend Lochhaven. No doubt her father was acting as protector of the Empire. She chafed at her feelings of helplessness. In her mind, she repeated her encounters with Prince Trevin over and over again. She could not believe that he had deliberately taken part in some ruse to infiltrate the Empire. But how could she prove it? Somehow she had seen through his disguise. Had the mysteries finally spoken to her? If so, why hadn't they also told her what to say to sway the council's decision? She wrestled with her feelings of helplessness. She knew she needed to take action, but she had no notion of what to do. It was on the third day that Hugild came to her with another letter from Will Russell. Preoccupied as she'd been with the war preparations, she'd almost forgotten about the missives. As she broke the seal and scanned the letter's contents, she remembered the letters that Lady Corinne had given her to return to her father. She'd been meaning to talk to Lord Fitzroy about them and ask his opinion, but her ability to focus had been seriously compromised. Will's letter was short and to the point. He was in the city down below. He'd been assigned as a dragoon on the Hurricane Vigor, and would be deployed the next afternoon to the massive ship that would be sent to defend the Empire. He asked if she could meet him that evening at Commander Falking's home in the city. He provided the street name and described the house. He would return the letters to her then.
"What did he say?"
Hugild asked her with a tone of concern. Sarah sighed and read it over a second time. "He's been assigned to a hurricane. He leaves tomorrow. This is the only night he can meet me." Sarah bit her lip. "Hugild, it feels as if we are truly going to war, and Will is part of that ministry. He could die. So many men and women will lose their lives because of this conflict. Why can't I stop it? They want to fight. Do we not have troubles enough without creating more?"
"What do you want to do?"
Hugild asked. Sarah turned the paper over in her hand. She dug her fingernail into the broken wax seal and picked it off. "I would like to go see him, but there is so much commotion everywhere. How would we get to the address he gave us?" Hugild shrugged.
"That's a safe neighborhood, Sarah. The officers don't live in the barracks. Any Zephyr pilot worth his salt could find it in a trice."
"But it is in the part of the city that lies beneath us," Sarah said. "Father never once let me go down there. What will Mother say?"
"Your mother's been invited to a society function with Lady Corinne tonight.
Hugild answered. I heard her mention it at breakfast. Didn't you? Sarah had been daydreaming about the prince and the coming conflict. In truth, she rarely listened to her mother's announcements. She shook her head, and Hugild smiled patiently. What I'm saying is, tonight would be ideal. I could arrange for the zephyr. Sarah's eyes brightened. The thought of the small adventure and the accompanying departure from her problems was undeniably appealing. I could wear a servant's gown as a disguise. Exactly, Hugild said. I won't tell your mother, Sarah. And getting those letters back is for your own good after all. Especially if your father still intends to get his hands on them and use them against you. Best to get them back and squash the potential harm. We should go after your mother leaves. Mr. Russell wanted to keep one of them, Sarah said worriedly. I wouldn't advise it, Hugild replied with a sigh. Maybe you can convince him to part with them all. The rest of the afternoon, Sarah prepared herself for the jaunt to the city. She had always wished to see it, and the prospect of seeing Will on the eve of his departure only added to her excitement. Mother was thrilled about the invitation she'd received to Lady Corinne's gathering at her Lockhaven house. It wasn't a ball, but such gatherings often lasted past midnight. Sarah wondered why Lady Corinne had invited her mother. She wasn't aware of any sort of friendship between the two, but maybe it was a signal of a change in favor?
Will you and Hugild be all right?
Mother asked after dinner, accepting Sarah's kiss on the cheek.
Oh, don't worry about us. We're old friends, Sarah answered innocently. Have a delightful evening.
She watched as her mother left, and then she went back to her rooms, where Hugild was waiting with a different dress for her to wear. Sarah quickly changed and donned a cloak with a veil, which was how many servants traveled at night. Nervous energy thrummed in her heart as they carefully descended the steps and slipped out the back into the gardens. None of the servants saw them leave. Hugild, casting careful glances around them, led her around the gardens to the gate leading to the front of the manor. She paused there, and Sarah felt her use a small pulse of power to dim the eyes of the leering there. The gate lock clicked, and Hugild pushed on the bars, opening it. No soldiers had protected the house for a few days now, as all of them had been summoned for duty elsewhere. Only two bodyguards had been left, and they were stationed inside the house. They walked side by side, cautiously and quietly, and crossed the small courtyard to the outer gate, where Hugild repeated her efforts to disable the leering. Beyond, they found a darkened zephyr parked on the street. The pilot was slouching, but as they approached, he snapped to attention.
Good evening, Madam Hugild, at your service. Have an errand to run in the city tonight. Should be down and back in no time, if you'd like to come aboard.
Yes, please, Hugild said, pulling her cloak tighter. The pilot opened the side gate of the Zephyr and lowered it, revealing a set of small steps leading to it. Hugild went first, as if she were the important passenger, and Sarah followed meekly. The pilot gave her a grin before following her up the platform. She nestled quietly on the small wooden bench next to Hugild.
Row Street it is, announced the pilot. Bit of fog tonight, my ladies, but you trust old Hamblin and he'll see you through it. I know the best ways up and down.
He started to hum to himself, and the Zephyr came alive and began to hover. Sarah's stomach lurched with a thrill as the skyship raced away from their dark and quiet street and passed over the rooftops of the neighboring houses. She looked back a few times to see if any other zephyrs were following them. There were none she could see.
I told you there was fog,
the pilot said as they reached the outer edge of Lockhaven. The city was smothered in clouds, the thick, impenetrable kind that Sarah had so often witnessed from the walls of her childhood manor. Only a few ghostly lights could be seen through them. The weather was ahead of the calendar. It already seemed like summer, and nightfall had only come an hour or so before. A few turrets poked up through the clouds, and Sarah pointed at them and whispered to Hugild, "What are they?" "Some are manors," her old governess explained.
Some are hotels for the wealthy who cannot find a place in Lockhaven. They want to get as close as they can and see the view at least from beneath.
Sarah nodded and felt her stomach lurch as the Zephyr plunged into the bank of fog. Little droplets of water collected on her veil and began to drip down. She was overly warm in her gloves, cloak, and gown, and wanted to whisk away the veil and feel the mist on her face. It had a hazy smell, the pungent scent of withered flowers. Her excitement continued to grow, but she was nervous, too. What if Mother returned suddenly to find her gone? Hugild would get in serious trouble again. It would not be the same as before, when Sarah had been little more than a child. The stakes were higher now. But her friend had accepted the risk. In fact, she'd arranged for the transportation on her own. And what they were doing was perfectly sensible. Getting the letters back from Will was a smart thing. Those thoughts helped assuage the nervous feelings twisting in her stomach, but they didn't banish them. The journey lasted no more than half an hour, and soon they descended through the mist to Rose Street. Leering lamps lit the way, but there were very few people around. The cobblestones were slick and wet. The buildings were 5, maybe 6 stories tall, fronted with stone, and quite stately. The roofs were sharply pointed, and lights glowed from window panes set into wooden beams. The Zephyr alighted on the landing yard for the street and soon settled into place.
"I'll wait right here,"
Hamblin said with a smile. He helped them down the squat steps of the ladder one at a time.
"Which one is it?" Hugild asked, looking at the various doors facing them from both sides of the street. Sarah had already memorized the address in the letter. "See the iron bell? It's that one," she said, pointing. Now that they had arrived, her anxiety pressed against her mind. She overruled it, eager to get the business done with. Hugild led the way, and Sarah followed, their shoes scraping against the wet cobbles. It felt like they had crossed into another world because the stones up in Lockhaven had all been dry. Hugild mounted the steps to the door and firmly knocked. It was a narrow-looking place, most of the homes were, and the color and form of the bricks were different between each of the homes on the streets. Though Sarah was surprised at the variety in style, the differences were not as major as she had supposed they'd be. This was still very much a part of her world, her empire. Sarah bit her lip in agitation and eagerness. Footsteps could be heard from inside, followed by the jangling of the door handle, and then there was Commander Falking on the landing, not a hat to be seen on his graying hair.
"Ah, you've arrived. Thank you, madam, for the note earlier. We were expecting you. Come in, come in."
He smiled broadly, though he cast a nervous glance over the street before ushering them in.
"Was the fog much of a devil to you on the way down? You had a good pilot, I hope."
Hugild glanced around nervously. There were no servants inside the house, and it felt still and empty. "He was very good," Sarah said, answering for her. She lifted the veil. "It's a pleasure to see you again, Commander." He gave her a strange look, neither fully a smile nor a wince, and bowed. Then he gestured for the hall.
"Well, the lad's been a bit nervous, to speak truthfully. This way, this way."
He began to walk down the narrow hall toward the sitting room doors. There was a small, well-lit study off to the side, but Sarah couldn't see if anyone was in there. She heard no noises, no footfalls except their own. The house was dead quiet. Falking must have dismissed his servants for the night in anticipation of their arrival. The fewer witnesses, the better, right? Why, then, did she feel as nervous and out of sorts as Hugild looked? Had this been an error in judgment? When they reached the study doors, Commander Falking opened them. Will was pacing inside. She recognized him instantly, although he was much taller, more muscular, and even more handsome than she remembered. He was wearing his regimentals, and his gloves were stuffed in his belt. The buttons on his jacket gleamed like huge bronze coins. His rank insignia, lieutenant, was on his shoulders. When he caught sight of her, he immediately stopped pacing. His mouth was so serious, as if he were indeed very nervous. He had transformed since their last meeting. He was a man now, and she felt very much as if she were still a girl of 12. Sarah tried to master her flurrying feelings. She strode into the chamber, extending her gloved hand. Why wasn't he wearing gloves? Aside from Minister Fitzroy, the only people she knew who regularly shirked them were Adam Cray and Seti. "Mr. Russell, it's so good to see you again," she began in a formal but cheerful way. Then she heard the door shut and lock behind her. Chapter 27 Thought Magic. The sound of the lock was subtle but unmistakable. Sarah was alone with Will. For a moment she could not think beyond the shock of the situation. Then she began to feel her legs tremble because it felt as if she'd been caught in a trap. Being alone with a young man was against the mores of her world. This was a social violation of the highest order.
"Thank you for agreeing to see me," Will said. "I thought it might not happen in time, but I was relieved when I received word from Falking that you were indeed coming."
He took her hand in his, and she realized she was still extending hers. Discomfort roiled inside of her. He did not seem so nervous now. A hint of a smile toyed with his mouth.
"Why did they shut the door?" Sarah asked haltingly. Hugild should be with us."
"You didn't seem to mind when you charged into the hedge maze with me," Will answered with a chuckle.
When he rubbed his thumb across her knuckle, she extricated her hand.
I'm here to get the letters," Sarah stammered, cursing herself for having agreed to this outing at all. Once again, she'd been too hasty. She was certain her cheeks were pink and her ears were quite hot. The way he looked at her, the handsome smile, the look of familiarity, showed that he was expecting something more than exchanging letters. Her throat tightened into a knot as tremors shook her body. Seti had warned Sarah that her heart might be more involved than she realized. How wise her friend had been.
"I know," he answered smoothly. "But I get to keep one of them, remember?"
"Yes, yes, I do remember that part." The room felt as if it were shrinking. There was a slight buzzing sound in her ears. She felt completely vulnerable, but she tried to rise above it. Only there was one thought she couldn't shake. Why had Hugild left them alone? She listened for a sound from the other side of the door, but she could only hear their mingled breaths in the room.
"You know," he said in a half-serious tone, "I believed all the things they taught us at school about thoughts and destiny. It's true."
She looked at his face, and again her body started to shake. Something felt off, unfamiliar, dangerous. She had not been summoned here in earnest.
"Where are the letters?" she asked.
Would her voice not stop trembling?
"I have them here," he said,
patting the pocket of his jacket. He slipped his hand into it and withdrew a bundle tied with a green ribbon. Seeing them made her feel a bit of relief. Perhaps she'd misinterpreted the situation, and there was nothing to worry about after all. His brown eyes looked deep and earnest in the dimly lit room. The only source of illumination was a single leering set above the fireplace. She was tempted to snatch the letters from his hand.
"May I have them, please?" she asked, holding out her hand.
"Of course, Sarah. I brought them for you. But it pains me to part with them, all but one. I want something in return. If I give you what you want, then you should return the favor."
He slid the bundle back into his pocket. Sarah's heart was pounding faster than horses now. She knew what he wanted without him asking. The image of them kissing came unbidden to her mind. Her mouth went dry, and fear and guilty excitement did battle inside her. She'd thought of kissing him, many times. She'd never had such an experience before, and Will was an exceptionally attractive man. And yet, this was wrong.
They didn't feel alone, even though they were. Her thoughts were like moths trapped in a jar. She could hardly make any sense of them.
"Don't be afraid of me,"
Will said softly, shaking his head. She saw his hands were trembling.
"Before I go, I had hoped."
He struggled to find words and failed. Part of her wanted to rebel against the rules, and yet... "Will," she said, not sure what to do. Her feelings told her one thing. Her sense told her another. He stepped even closer.
"Yes?"
"I don't think we should," she said thickly.
"You can think right now,"
he said with a suppressed chuckle.
"I've imagined this moment for the last 4 years. An opportunity to be alone with you. With you, Sarah Fitz-Empress. I've wanted to see you again since that day your father forced me to leave you. How I wish we could have studied at the same school. Seen each other every day."
He shook his head, his eyes blazing with emotion.
"He robbed that from me. From us. I don't have any expectations from you, Sarah. Just give me a memory that I can take with me into battles that are coming. If I'm to die on an airship, I want that memory to linger on my mouth. Please, Sarah."
He turned his head slightly, his voice husky and earnest.
"Please."
His words had a calming effect on her. Instead of the frantic beating of the surf, her heart now felt like a bird trapped in a cage. The panic was receding. Calm assurance was replacing the disquiet. She did ache to touch him. He took another step closer. They were so very close.
"Please,"
he whispered again. The cravings inside her were so intense she could hardly breathe, let alone speak. She wanted the memory too. Lowering her lashes, she nodded to him. She had already lifted her veil after coming into the house. His fingers traced the edge of it near her face and brushed it slightly back. The tips of his fingers grazed her cheek, sending a jolt of awareness through her. He leaned down, pausing a moment, and she smelled his breath. It had a pleasant fragrance. The light from the leering exposed the slight blush on his face. Suddenly, she couldn't bear the thought of the stone statue staring at her. In her mind, she commanded it to go dark. The light from the leering shrank until it disappeared entirely, leaving them both in deep shadow. There were 3 large windows on the far wall, veiled and curtained. There was only one source of light, the lampposts from the street behind the house. It illuminated the room just enough for them to see each other.
"You like that better?"
he asked her in a gentle way. Again she nodded. And then she leaned up on her tiptoes to press her mouth to his. When they kissed, her mind swooned from the warmth and passion and energy of it. His arms wrapped around her shoulders, and he pressed against her. She held her hands in front of her, not able to succumb so fully to the moment, as if she knew she should push him away. A feeling of delicious warmth soaked through her. The hunger in her grew into a lion's roar. He was kissing her mouth, and then her cheek, and then her neck. Each press of his lips made her more and more uncomfortable, more dangerously delirious. "Will," she breathed, pushing against him. His hands came up and untied the veil and hat, which dropped down her back. "Will, stop," she said, trying to push against him again. Her voice sounded weak in her own ears.
"Sarah,"
he breathed, and then he was kissing her neck again. Part of her begged her to surrender to him. Her passions were inflamed. This was the reason that propriety was so strict. Her willpower shriveled in the face of such heat, such passion. But she would not compromise her standards even further. "No, Will, no," she said, feeling anger replace the flush of desire. This was more than a kiss farewell. This was a greedy demand,
an urge he was satisfying for himself. He didn't care about her feelings, only his. She pushed harder, and he finally backed away. His knuckles came up and rubbed his bottom lip. He didn't look wounded or hurt. He looked almost gleeful. "Give me the letters now," she said, feeling more in control of herself. He smirked and fished them out of his pocket again.
"How about we read them again first? The ones I sent you were all destroyed by your father, I know. But these are precious to me."
"Give them to me," she insisted. He shook his head.
"You can't leave so soon, Sarah. I just need to entertain you a little longer. There are other ways we can do that, of course. Ones that are more interesting."
"How dare you?" Sarah said indignantly. A sudden rush of anger restored her strength.
"Oh, I dare much,"
he answered, his tone growing colder.
"It won't be long now. Your mother was forbidden entry to Lady Corinne's party. In fact, she was never invited. No doubt she's back home by now, and you aren't there. Has the panic settled in yet? Where is her daughter? Where did she go? Who is she with?"
Sarah realized with dread that it had been a trap, after all. One that had been carefully orchestrated, and she, gullible and naive as she was, had walked into it.
"I'm sorry," he said with an unapologetic shrug. "I had hoped for a little more fun before you realized what happened. What you'll be blamed for."
He reached for her hand and brought it up to his mouth. She slapped him with her other hand, rocking his head back. "I'm going, Mr. Russell," she said with blistering rage. "Letters or no." She strode to the door and knocked on it firmly. No one answered. There still wasn't any sound on the other side. Had Hugild betrayed her too? The thought sickened her. Will put his hand on her shoulder.
"They're not coming," he said coaxingly. "We are truly alone in an abandoned house. You need to be here just long enough for suspicions to firm, for your reputation to be irrevocably damaged."
"How could you do such a thing?" Sarah said, whirling around and hitting his chest with her fists. The thought of being caught alone in a home with him. Well, there was no doubt what the Privy Council would think. This would disqualify her from becoming Empress, certainly. Wasn't that the point? Vast sums were betting on the outcome. Yet, like everything else, the speculation had been rigged by one more of the players. And she had unwittingly become an accessory to her own downfall.
"I am being well rewarded for spending this time with you," he answered,
jerking back when she tried to hit him again. She turned and yanked on the door handles, but they were locked and wouldn't budge.
"Please, Sarah. You're not going to break down that door. I doubt even I could."
"You are a scoundrel and a rake," she said, turning on him venomously.
"And you are the daughter of a selfish puppet," he shot back. "One who punishes those who do not deserve it, a hypocrite and a fool."
"I thought better of you, Will Russell."
"I was wrong." "You're wrong about a lot of things," he said. "And even if you got out those doors, where would you go? The Zephyr isn't waiting for you. And you have no idea how the world down here works. We're both of us caught in a cage."
He shrugged.
"We wait now for the jailer to arrive."
He began to unbutton his coat. "What are you doing?"
"It needs to look convincing, Sarah. Maybe a few loose buttons on your gown?"
A blinding white heat seared her mind. "If you touch me again, I swear I'll..." He chuckled, raising his eyebrows.
"You think a threat will work in such a moment as this? I'm a dragoon, Sarah."
He finished unbuttoning his jacket and then tossed it on the floor where it lay in a heap. Sarah turned around and pounded on the door again. "Hugild! Hugild!" she shouted. Will came up behind her and, seizing her around the waist, pulled her from the door.
"I'm not going to hurt you, lass, but I won't have you causing a racket."
"Let go of me! Let go!" Sarah struggled against him, and he released her, sending her away from the door. She rubbed her arms, trembling all over. She wanted